Well, I'm going to start a new series tonight looking at the first three chapters of Genesis, which are, of course, also the first three chapters of the Bible. I've entitled the series, I guess, fairly unimaginatively, In the Beginning. Those are the first three words of the Bible and of these three chapters then. And so we're looking tonight just at the opening two verses. Not getting very far this evening, but they are epic verses. I'm sure you'll agree, and I'll just read them again now. So Genesis 1, verses 1 and 2. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters, over the face of the waters. And I have then two headings as we look at these verses this evening. And first of all, truth that demands. Truth that demands. So our text this evening comprises lovely, poetic, evocative, memorable words. You remember how A Tale of Two Cities famously begins, "It was the best of times, it was the worst of times." 1984 opens with, "It was a bright, cold day in April and the clocks were striking 13. And then there's the first line of Pride and Prejudice. "It is a truth universally acknowledged that a single man in possession of a good fortune must be in want of a wife." But Charles Dickens and George Orwell and Jane Austen are matched by Moses here. The book of Genesis, indeed the Bible itself, begins just as elegantly and arrestingly as any of those classics of English literature. And it's right then that we recognize that and that we admire and that we savor the literary beauty of these two verses. But we mustn't just do that, because there's a real sense in which they are hard-hitting verses. They are confrontational. They can't merely be enjoyed in a detached way as one might enjoy a poem by Wordsworth. No, these lines make huge claims which, if true, demand that we adjust our whole approach to life accordingly. That's what I mean by truth that demands. You can't casually smile at Genesis 1, 1 and 2 and then just move on. It makes demands of you. For starters, there's that phrase, "in the beginning." Now, pretty much everything we know has a beginning and it has an end. I mentioned then some well-known novels a moment ago. Every novel that you've ever read has a beginning and it has an end. Every exam does. Every tennis match does. Every school holiday does. This is how things work. They have a beginning and they have an end. But with some things, I guess, it doesn't feel like that. With some things, it feels like they just are. Timelessly, perpetually. Marks and Spencers, for instance. Surely Marks and Spencers is just baked in. It's a given. It's part of the fabric. It's a non-negotiable. You can't conceive of an era pre-Marks and Spencers. You can't conceive of an era post-Marks and Spencers. That's how it feels to us who have known Marks and Spencers as this constant, stable backdrop to our lives. But in actual fact, of course, Marks and Spencers did once have a beginning in 1884 in Leeds. And it will no doubt one day have an end too. Eventually some new trend in the world of retail will get the better of it and it won't be able to adapt and it will go the same way as Debenhams and Woolworths went. Hard though it may be for us to take in, Marks and Spencers in fact conforms to the same principle as everything else does. It has a beginning and it has an end. But if Marks and Spencers gives off this feeling of being timeless and perpetual, there's something that does so even more. The universe. Surely when it comes to the universe, we are dealing with something that just is. Surely even if everything else follows the same scheme of beginning, carrying on for a finite length of time and then ending. Surely the universe eludes that scheme. Surely it's different. Surely it has always been and always will be. Well, the opening words of Genesis are saying no, even the universe has a beginning. In the beginning, verse 1 thunders, and the beginning to which it's referring isn't the beginning of a novel or an exam or a tennis match or a school holiday or even Marks and Spencer's, it's the beginning of the heavens and the earth, the universe, in other words. The universe hasn't always existed. Matter hasn't always existed. Shape and size and colour haven't always existed. Light and darkness haven't always existed. Air hasn't always existed. Science hasn't always existed. These things once began. The cosmos itself, no less than that retail giant in Leeds, experienced a starting point. It did so, of course, a lot earlier, a long time before 1884, but it did so. For it, as much as for anything else you care to think of, there was a decisive moment when it came into being. And here's the thing then. What does that imply? If the universe has a beginning, what does that imply? It implies that the universe also has an end. The universe has an end. And I'm saying to you this evening then that before we even get any further into our text, that is a confrontational and demanding truth for us to get our heads around. The end of the world. That's not the stuff of Hollywood movies, merely. It's not a handy image for pop singers trying to capture the feeling of being jilted by your lover. No, the end of the world is a real approaching event. Because if the world has a beginning, it will also have an end. And I ask them, what are you doing about that? What are you doing about the fact that time will one day be called on the universe itself? Oh, that all of us might be able to sing truly from our hearts what we sang a moment ago with our lips. Lead, Lord Jesus, my frail spirit, to that rock so strong and high, standing sure mid surging tempest, safe when pounding waves are nigh. In the rock of ages hiding, come there flood or fiery blaze, when the whole creation crumbles, and the creation is going to crumble. Rock of ages, thee I'll praise. When earth's rocks are cleft asunder by the terror of that day, when as cruel storms beat on them, strong men cringe in fear away, that sure rock will still be standing, midst the waters, midst the blaze, there on heaven's eternal ocean, rock of ages, thee I'll praise. But on this subject of truth that demands, let's go now a bit further into the text. I said just now that matter and molecules and organisms all have a beginning. Everything that makes up this universe, its largest components, its minutest components, there's no part of it that did not once begin. However, our text does present us with something that didn't begin. It says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. I talked about that idea of something that just is, timelessly and perpetually. And I said that tempting though it may be, you can't apply that idea to Marks and Spencer's. And I said that even more tempting though it may be, you can't even apply that idea to the universe. But here now, in our text, we have a being to whom you can apply that idea. God. God. Clearly, God did not begin when atoms and particles and chemicals began. If he did, they couldn't begin because there would have been nothing to cause them to begin. For there to be a beginning of everything else, there had to be someone who did not begin, who was simply there all along, and in a position, therefore, to make everything else begin. And God then is that being. God is a being. Our text is saying without any origin, without any commencement, a being whose own history just reaches back endlessly, infinitely. Please think about that for a moment. What constitutes greatness? How do you measure it? How do you measure greatness? A few weeks ago, we had the annual New Year's Honours List come out. I don't know whether or not you had a look at it, but if you did, you'll have seen that Gareth Southgate was on there, the latest England football manager to fail to win a single trophy. He was on the New Year's Honours List. You'll also have seen that Alan Titchmarsh was on there, a man who has spent his working life telling us how to plant geraniums. He was on the New Year's Honours List. Now, I have nothing against either of those gentlemen, but I can't help feeling that when it comes to being a great figure in our society, the bar is not set particularly high. But you know, there is a being who never, ever, 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 ever began. That's greatness. That's greatness. But again, there's a demanding side to all this too. Because if there's a being who is that great, a being who is dependent on nothing else for his own existence, but on whom everything else is dependent for its existence, because he single-handedly created the heavens and the earth, if there's a being who is that great, you and I cannot afford to ignore him. We use that phrase, don't we? The elephant in the room. We use it to describe something that's big and unignorable, and yet which everyone is ridiculously doing their best to ignore. Imagine it then. We're here in this service tonight. We're singing the third hymn, and I noticed then during the opening verse of the third hymn, an elephant walk into the foyer. It wanders round and it just kind of loiters there near the sliding door, near the recording desk. And we sing the hymn, we finish singing it. Now at that point, I can't just launch into my sermon, can I? As though everything is perfectly normal. I've got to, at the very least, mention the thing, ask if anyone in the congregation has any experience of handling elephants. I've got to make some kind of response to this giant creature that is in our midst. And if there's a being out there who never began and who created by himself the heavens and the earth, we've got to respond to him. We've got to bow before him. We've got to submit our lives to him. We've got to make him the sun around which we orbit. And I ask then, are you doing that? You would respond to an elephant towering over the recording desk. Are you responding to the God who towers over the universe? So I'm saying there's truth that demands here in our text. The world is going to end. That, I would say, is a pretty consequential thing for us all to take on board. But that's not all. There's this mind-blowingly great being who exists called God, a being who takes greatness to a whole other level. These are things then that demand serious attention. Please don't patronize Genesis 1, 1 and 2. Please don't evade their force with bland comments about the loveliness of the language. Face up, all of you, frankly, to the huge claims that these verses are making. Truth that demands. But then secondly this evening, truth that draws. Truth that draws. So verse 1 presents then this eternal, all-creating God. But are we talking then about a being who is just raw power? Just an intimidating concentration of unsheathed almightiness. Is that what we're talking about? Well, no. Because in verse 2, we see that this creator God, well, yes, is terrifyingly great, he is also attractive. He is also attractive. The verse draws us to his beauty. And in that connection, then, I have three words for you. And the first word is preoccupation. Preoccupation. Notice what happens as we move from verse 1 into verse 2. Notice that there's a narrowing there of the focus. Verse 1, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. Verse 2, the earth was dot, dot, dot. Now what's happened to the heavens? They've kind of quietly dropped out of the picture as we move from verse 1 into verse 2. As I say, there's this narrowing, this very dramatic narrowing of the focus. And that narrowed focus then will continue throughout the entire creation account. It will hardly show any interest at all in anything beyond this planet. The account ventures briefly into the wider solar system in verse 16, and perhaps further than that in the very fleeting reference to the stars in the same verse. But otherwise, the heavens disappear from view after verse 1. And God's creating of distant galaxies beyond the capacities of our finest 21st century telescopes, it just doesn't feature here. Now, it's important, of course, that God does create distant galaxies that are beyond the capacities of our finest 21st century telescopes. And that tells us things about him. Some of you may remember a talk that Alan gave on a Wednesday night quite a while ago now, in which he talked about God painting behind the wardrobe. And he said that he, that is Alan, decorating his bedroom, didn't bother to move the wardrobe away from the wall and paint behind it, because after all, no one's ever going to see that bit of paintwork anyway. But Alan went on to point out that God did not adopt that approach. He wasn't all functional and utilitarian when he created the universe. Oh, I'll only create what's strictly necessary and nothing more. No, he created far more than was necessary. Excessively more than was necessary. Gratuitously more than was necessary. And amongst other things, then, I guess that illustrates the truth of Romans 11:36, doesn't it? I preached on that at some point last year, where Paul says, from him, that's God, from him, and through him, and to him are all things. And that to him there, I'm thinking of now. All things ultimately have their goal in God. Ultimately, in the last analysis, the universe wasn't created for us. It was created for him, for his enjoyment, for his pleasure. And distant galaxies, therefore, that are of no use whatsoever to us, they're great use to him in the sense of giving him pleasure. He enjoys them. He enjoyed putting them there, and he enjoys them being there right now. So, as I say then, the fact that God does create distant galaxies that are way beyond anything that we can possibly comprehend, that tells us things about him. But I'm saying now, the fact that the creation account he has given us largely disregards the distant galaxies, that also tells us things about him. And wonderfully then, it tells us that he has this strange preoccupation with the earth. I mean, that's extraordinary, isn't it? Do you remember that line in Psalm 8? Psalm 8, verse 3. When I look at your heavens, the work of your fingers. The work of your fingers, that's an interesting image, isn't it? Not the more usual image, the work of your hands, but the work of your fingers. Why the work of your fingers? Is there any difference between those two images? Well, I think there is. If I were describing moving this chair from one part of the room to another, I might well say, well, I lifted it with my hands. Did that action. If, however, I were describing mending a sabutio player, whose legs had come apart from its base, Then I might say I fixed it with my fingers. Why? Well, because a sabutio player is tiny. Its legs are tinier still. Fastening those legs to that little base, it's a fiddly, delicate job. It's for fingers rather than for hands. And the psalmist then is describing God's creating activity as finger work. In other words, God here is dealing with things that are tiny and fiddly to him. And yet, the things which the psalmist has in mind when he says that, it's the heavens. That's what he says there, isn't it? When I consider the heavens, the work of your fingers. So those 100 billion galaxies that to us are just so staggeringly, unprocessably, incalculably enormous, they're tiny and they are fiddly to God. What then must the earth be to God? If the heavens are like that, the galaxies, if they are tiny and fiddly to him, what must the earth be to God? And yet, as I say, he has this strange preoccupation with it. Suppose I'm on holiday and I'm at the beach and I have this bucket that's full of sand. And Hannah comes along and I'm there with this bucket of sand and I'm earnestly rummaging through it. And she says, "What are you doing?" And I says, "Well, I'm looking for a grain of sand." And she says, "Well, it's full of grains of sand." "Ah, no," I said, "but there's a particular one. There's a particular one I'm looking for." And I carry on rummaging. "Ah, there it is," I say. And I pull out this grain. I knock all the other ones away off my finger. And I have this one grain of sand. And carefully, for the rest of the holiday, I look after this grain of sand. And I take it home with me. And when I get home, I put it on the mantelpiece. And every day I go and look at it and I check that it's okay and its condition is fine. I mean, people would be calling the doctors, wouldn't they? A big adult human being preoccupied with a minuscule grain of sand. But that doesn't begin to capture the sheer oddness and incongruity of an infinite God preoccupied with one imperceptible little dot within his universe, planet Earth. But throughout Genesis 1, we see him, don't we? Busy, 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 busy with his little grain of sand, separating the land from the water and covering it with vegetation and filling it with animals and all these different things, strangely obsessed with something so seemingly unworthy of his attention. And of course, his obsession won't stop after 7 days of creation. He'll continue to be preoccupied with the earth over the ensuing centuries. Indeed, that preoccupation will become so intense that eventually it will take him into quite unthinkable territory. And he'll somehow contrive to shrink himself down, 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 down to a size so small that he can actually get onto his grain of sand. And he can get onto little planet Earth and live there amongst the vegetation and amongst the animals. What a God this is. Perhaps sometimes you think to yourself, who am I kidding? Praying to God every night, pouring out my heart to him and offloading all my burdens on him, as though the God who made this universe is going to be remotely interested in my little life. This massive God, I'm not even going to cross his mind ever. But actually, you see, God has always gravitated towards the small and the unnoticeable. We see him doing it from the very second verse of the Bible. This narrowing of the focus from the heavens and the earth to just little earth. And your smallness and your unnoticeableness, therefore, don't put you beyond God's range of vision and interest. Quite the opposite. You can say this evening with the psalmist in Psalm 40, verse 17, "As for me, I am poor and needy, but the Lord takes thought for me." The Lord takes thought for me. I'm poor, I'm needy, I'm titchy. I'm insignificant, I'm inconsequential, I'm the merest blip on the giant radar screen of the cosmos, and yet the Lord takes thought for me. That's the kind of God he is. This preoccupation with that which you would have thought an infinite God would be utterly uninterested in. And so I'm saying there's beauty in this preoccupation that draws us here. But then a second word, process. Process. Verse 2 begins, then the earth, we've already talked about that narrowing of the focus, but the earth, it says, was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep. Now, what on earth is going on here? God has engaged in this creative activity recorded in verse 1, and yet the result of that creative activity, as far as the earth is concerned at least, seems rather unimpressive, doesn't it? I mean, what is the result? It's some kind of watery, shapeless mess. That's what without form means. And it's utterly barren. There's nothing there. That's what void means. So what's happened here? Has God made a hash of the whole thing? Has he made a dog's dinner of this creative activity? Well, no. It's simply that he's going to make his creation how he wants it to be through a process rather than instantaneously. Why? Does he lack the power to do it instantaneously? Of course not. Why then? Well, because he finds that satisfying and pleasurable. And if you don't know what I mean by that, you've clearly never seen a child with a Lego set. Apologies for bringing Lego up again, as I did this morning. Why does a child even want a Lego set? I mean, let's suppose it's a Lego aeroplane. And there are model aeroplanes available in toy shops that are already constructed and ready to play with straight away. So why, instead of one of those that you can play with immediately, why instead does the child put on his Christmas list a Lego aeroplane set where the plane is going to be in all these bits and it's going to be unrecognizable when he first opens the packets? And he's not going to be able to play with it on Christmas morning, perhaps not even on Christmas afternoon or Christmas evening. Might be a few days before it's in a fit state for him to be able to play with that plane, because it'll take time to follow the instructions and to construct this thing. Why does he want that? Why not one that's already there to zoom around the room? Well, because there's a pleasure in that process of, first of all, putting together one wing, and then putting together the other wing of the plane, and then the undercarriage, and then the start of the plane's nose, and so on. Seeing it gradually take shape and come together, marking the progress that's made. And I'm saying then, God knows that pleasure. Indeed, we're kind of looking at things the wrong way around here, aren't we? Whether or not the child realizes it, the child enjoys that Lego building process precisely because he bears the image of God. And just then, as a God who is preoccupied with the little and the unnoticeable is attractive, and that's a characteristic that draws us to him, doesn't this one too that we're talking about now? His enjoyment of process. It means that this is a deeply personal God. He's not some kind of cosmic AI. AI can't derive satisfaction from gradual process. AI is about answers and solutions produced as efficiently and clinically as possible. If AI were creating the universe, then it wouldn't be a drawn out and cumulative process. It would be quick and direct and soulless. Because AI is what it says on the tin. It's It's artificial. There's no authentic personhood there. But God is a being pulsating with authentic personhood. A being with a warm heart who takes delight in things, who takes delight in watching projects develop and blossom and move from small beginnings to grand culminations. It's why he employs the same method that he employs at the beginning in other areas as well. You think of the advance of the gospel in these last days. And God doesn't then Christianize the world in a stroke on the day of Pentecost. He could do that, but he doesn't do that. Instead, he inaugurates on that day of Pentecost a process whereby the gospel will take hold, first of all in Jerusalem, and then in Judea, and then in Samaria, and then to the ends of the earth. And it's a process that has been gathering pace and gathering momentum now for 2,000 years, the gospel gradually going to all different corners of the world. And then we see the same thing, and we talked about it in our prayer, and we sang about it in our hymn. We see the same thing in his making you and me like our elder brother, Jesus Christ. Again, he doesn't make you suddenly entirely like Jesus on the day that you're converted. He could do that, but he doesn't. Instead, on the day you're converted, he inaugurates this process whereby over time, through exposure to the means of grace, you will be changed from glory into glory. And it's attractive then, I'm saying this. What a wonderfully unartificial, unrobotic God we have. A God who enjoys things progressing and advancing and going forward and gradually taking shape. This is a beautiful God. So we've seen two things that draw us toward him: preoccupation, process, and then one more word as we close, plurality. Plurality. So verse 2 continues, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. What on earth is that about? Well, it's indicating then that as this process that we've just been talking about, as it unfolds over the ensuing verses, God's activity is not going to be one-dimensional. It's going to be complex. There's a great essay that the late 19th, early 20th century theologian Benjamin Warfield wrote called The Spirit of God in the Old Testament. And he explores the Spirit's role here. And he talks about how you have here in the creation account, God on the outside of creation, kind of making these commands, let there be, da-da-da, let there be, da-da-da. But you also have God on the inside of the creation, the Spirit of God here, kind of implementing what is being commanded from outside and facilitating that and bringing that to effect. And in creation then we see plurality within God. There's God the commander outside the creation, and there's also God the implementer inside the creation. And as the Bible goes on then, that plurality becomes more and more pronounced, until finally it will be unmistakable that it's a plurality of actual persons. Three properly distinct persons. So distinct indeed that one of them, just one of them, to the exclusion of the others, can become a human being and can die on a cross. Something utterly unshared by the other persons. And this then is the most beautiful thing of all about God. That he is three persons who in creation and then in redemption adopt these different but entirely complementary roles. And it's such a delightful and sublime thing. I've probably hit my quota already of football-related illustrations today, but indulge me one more on whatever evening it was, Wednesday evening, I think, Newcastle United were playing, and their star player at the moment, their striker, Alexander Isak, he had scored two goals. And he then ran with the ball into the penalty area, had an opportunity to shoot and get his hat trick. But instead, he didn't. He passed the ball across the face of the goal, and one of the other players was able to hit it into the back of the net. And people were talking about this afterwards and saying it was a very strange thing that this guy, he didn't go for the hat trick. Instead, he was so ungrasping and so cooperating with his teammates instead of claiming all the glory for himself. And people found this then very attractive. And they lauded him for this. Why is that? Well, I would suggest to you it's because what they were seeing on that football pitch is a faint, faint reflection, though most of the people who were talking about it don't know this. It's a faint, faint reflection of the God who has made them for himself, and they're restless till they find their rest in him. Because in God, supremely and consummately, there's this plurality of persons who are ungrasping and cooperative and helping the other and assisting the other and working with the other. And we find it lovely when we see that kind of thing in human society, because we're wired up to engage with a God in whom that exists on a different scale altogether. And so look beyond tonight, the Newcastle United footballers, to the real thing, to that beautiful harmony of interrelationship that we see in the being of God, who is Father and His Son and His Spirit, and one does this and another does that and another does the next thing, and they all combine to create a universe and then to save a people of which you and I are a part. What a God. Worship and adore Him and reflect then on His preoccupation with earth and with the little and the unnoticeable. On His love of process and of this plurality, God, who is Father, Son, and Spirit. Amen. We're going to close on that.